The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Tonight, we have the good fortune to spend the hour with Drs. Temple Grandin and Deborah Moore, who have synthesized their decades of personal and professional experience into their new book, Navigating Autism, 9 Mindsets for Helping Kids on the Spectrum. Dr. Temple Grandin is a leader and activist for both the animal welfare and autism advocacy efforts. She is a Time Magazine Top 100 Hero, the author of more than 60 scientific papers, and professor of animal science at Colorado State University. Her semi-autobiographical nonfiction books, Emergence, Thinking in Pictures, and The Autistic Brain, inform scientists and a still largely uninformed general public about autism. Psychologist Dr. Deborah Moore is the founder and director of Fall Creek Counseling Associates, a landmark practice that works with children, teens, and adults with autism. The author and co-author of many scholarly and popular works on autism, gaming, addiction, and internet addiction, she collaborated with Grandin on the 2016 book, The Loving Push, How Parents and Professionals Can Help Spectrum Kids Become Successful Adults. Temple Grandin, Deborah Moore, it's great to have you join us this evening. The screen is yours.
Thank you, Andy. We're happy to be here. So Temple, let's talk about a combination of the book and your personal life and my clinical experience. I thought maybe we could start out by talking about the need to look beyond labels. We mentioned that a lot in the book, Navigating Autism. And I was wondering if you could tell folks, how do you regard the idea of the label of autism?
Well, Deborah, I really like what you've said about label locking, where I'm seeing parents and doctors and other people just seeing the label and the kid becomes a label. And in Navigating Autism, one of the things that's really emphasized in mindset number 2 is looking at the whole child. I think it's a big problem, and it's especially a problem in autism, because autism goes from someone like Elon Musk. I've always thought he was autistic when I read Ashley Vance's book, but now he announced it on Saturday Night Live, so now I can say it. Einstein landed in an autism class today, no speech until age 3. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have somebody that doesn't talk and maybe can't dress themselves, and they all have the same name. Where if someone is diagnosed with dyslexia or ADHD, that's a much more narrower, the people that would be put with that label be much more narrow. They can't read, or they're just, you know, attention deficit distractible. But this is the problem in autism. And the thing is a little bit of autism might give you some advantages. I've been out to Silicon Valley, socially awkward computer programmers, they're running those tech companies. They have a little bit of autism. See, that's the problem. A little bit of the trait could give you some advantages. I just went to a very large trial lawyers meeting. These are top lawyers. They are arguing in the Supreme Court. I gave a talk there. I can't believe the number of lawyers that came up to me telling me that they had autistic kids and fully verbal autistic kids, older autistic kids. And this brings up another thing. We're doing a good job with the little kids, but where we're falling down is transitioning the adults to adulthood. Fully verbal young adults addicted to video games, getting overprotected, not learning basic life skills. I think that's a very, very big problem.
Yeah, we talk about each one of those, and we can talk a little bit more in detail about each one of those this evening as well. I'm curious how the label autism, how do you use it for yourself, and how has it impacted you personally?
Well, I make sure in all my talks that people know that I am a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. And autism is an important part of who I am, but career comes first.
And if I interject, Temple, you are one of the top 10 voted college professors in America last year.
Yeah, that was really an honor. And also, I've spent 25 years working out construction projects with steel and concrete work and machinery design for large meatpacking plants. And I've worked with a lot of talented machinery designers that have 20 patents, welders that build all kinds of equipment and inventions. And I'm going to guess that 20% of them were autistic, dyslexic, or ADHD. And they're retiring. They're not getting replaced. And the reason they're not getting replaced is we've taken all the hands-on classes out of the schools. Worst thing we ever did. Some states are putting them back in. But I've worked with one guy who stutters. He would definitely be labeled autistic today. Dyslexic, ADHD, owns a big metal fabrication company. And he was saved by a single welding class.
Part of what you're saying is people on the spectrum or any person, they're going to develop skills only if they're exposed to something.
Exactly.
And this today, with all the classes out there, there are no welding classes anymore. There are no wood shop, but there are some, but in most schools, they don't exist anymore. So those kids don't get to develop those skills. And I think the other thing that you're saying is that the folks that you've met in your career who have these technical skills and they're on the spectrum, being on the spectrum is what makes them so good at what they do.
Well, that's the problem. And I think another thing I talk about is different kinds of minds. And one of the other emphasis of navigating autism is focusing on the kids' strengths and not their deficits. And I'm what's called an object visualizer. In fact, I discussed this in my book, The Autistic Brain. Everything I think about is a picture. And I was shocked to find out when I got into my 30s that a lot of people think completely verbally in words. And then you've got other people that are the visual, spatial, mathematical thinkers. And the first step is realizing that different thinking exists. And school systems, I think, have gotten pretty well taken over by the verbal thinkers. Very top down, very abstract, overgeneralization. And we also need our object visualizers. You see, in doing all kinds of things, you need, you know, all the different kinds of minds. My mother always developed my ability in art, and she encouraged me to do lots of different kinds of art.
Yeah. You know, you were saying in education, there are a lot of verbal thinkers, and I think that's true in all of the therapy fields as well. We tend, certainly in psychology, we tend to be very highly verbal. And we need to change that and match it to the kid. We need to use more visual tools, and we need to use more visual metaphors. And sometimes when we're verbal, if we're not getting through, it's as though we're talking to someone who's hard of hearing, and we start to speak louder. We start to use even more words. That's not going to make any sense. That's going to impact negatively the communication. I have heard you say many times that if someone is talking too quickly, or if there are a lot of voices in the room going, it becomes very difficult for you.
Well, the problem is I've got a really slow processor speed, and the viewers may have already noticed that I interrupted you, Deborah, several times. And part of the problems that I have is I simply can't get the timing right. I'm going to have problems with a lot of jobs with multitasking. People talking really fast, there's too much background noise, I can't screen it out. I also am not able to remember long strings of verbal directions, that I need to write them down in a checklist format. Now, if you're doing something like welding, or maybe you're doing computer programming, which the mathematical minds are good at, you don't do multitasking. That stuff all goes off of long-term memory.
Right. And that's so for both educators to recognize and parents to recognize. Anything, you know, any small task, sometimes we just forget and say, can you do this and do that and do that? That's two things too many.
Yeah, it's...
And you talk about a pilot's checklist. Maybe
well,
you can talk
pilot's
about
checklist,
what that is.
And they have to do it every time they fly the airplane. I know when United pushes the plane back, I know they're doing the pre-taxi checklist, then the plane turns, and they have to do it every single flight. It's not optional.
Right. So if you want a kid to learn how to do something at a new job, they need to have their own version of a pilot's checklist, and they need to go through it each and every time. They need someone to explain it to them, and then they need to have it there as a backup.
And then eventually, let's say something like cleaning an ice cream machine, and you've got to tear it down, then clean it, put it back together again. Eventually, they could probably drop the checklist. But for a couple of weeks, they are definitely going to need it. Because the problem is, I do not remember verbal sequence. And then employers get frustrated. So, well, what is he, stupid or something? Or I showed him how to do the ice cream machine 5 times. But you need step 1, step 2, step 3. And you can just put a keyword for each step. You know, remove the top might be the first step. Pull out the mixer. You know, I'm just making up parts for an ice cream machine. But it would be just like very simple. Remove the top. There'd be 3 words. That's step 1. Step 2, pull out the mixer.
You used a word just now that I want to piggyback on. You used the word stupid. And I think that's a word that has a lot of relevance to this conversation, because when we don't understand people, sometimes we think they're not as intelligent. And that's a big mistake.
One of the things that motivated me in my 20s to do the projects that were shown in the movie, and in the HBO movie Temple Grandin, it shows exactly how I think visually. You want to find out visual thinking works, watch that movie. It shows it accurately. But it also showed the projects that I did. The projects are accurate. And one of the things that motivated me in my 20s is I wanted to prove to people I was not stupid. That was a very big motivation in my 20s.
Well, you certainly have. And, you know, I think we talk about levels of functioning in autism, and I'm not crazy about that, because oftentimes it corresponds to verbal functioning, and verbal functioning is not necessarily a reflection of what's inside that person's brain and what they're capable of communicating if they have assistive technology.
Well, that's absolutely right. Like Tito Mukhopadhyay, for example, can type completely independently, and he has trouble controlling his movements. Then somebody else was nonverbal, they were a beautiful artist. Right. There was another person who was only partially verbal, and they were doing some higher level mathematics. But you're not going to know what they're capable of doing unless they got exposed to that mathematics. You see, you get into the problem, I've seen this in elementary school, where the teacher will say, well, that's not the age appropriate math. I go, no, if that third grader can do college algebra, give them the book and let them do it. Best to give them an old-fashioned book. That's all numbers. That's what a numbers kid wants.
That's right. Well, there's nothing much worse than a bored kid, bored person, period.
Well, bored kid is just going to turn into a behavior problem.
Right, right. Let's talk about strengths for a little bit and how to bring them out and how to expose kids so that they can utilize those strengths.
Well, kids get exposed to things. Just the other day, I was on a Zoom call, the mom's a second grader had gone out and was checking out salamanders that were in a puddle and got absolutely fascinated by salamanders. Then they got the whole second grade class involved in this. And it was just something right there in the neighborhood. And that's why I did another book, The Outdoor Scientist, just to get kids outside doing things. And an interest in salamanders could turn into a career in wildlife biology or conservation, because some of the amphibians are endangered. But that's showing kids interesting things. Right. A lot of kids are growing up today and they don't know where anything comes from. I had a student last semester who had never used a ruler to measure anything. Last year, I had a student that didn't know what a container ship was. She had no idea how her sandals got here from China. No idea. And then I showed her a picture of a container ship.
Yeah. But I encourage parents, when their child has an interest, to take that particular interest and sit down sometime and just brainstorm, maybe with the rest of the family or a friend, all the ideas that could sort of come out of that one interest. So for salamanders, find 20 other things related to environments that salamanders are or people who would work with salamanders, and just make that list, because it doesn't come to you spontaneously. And when you've been working all day and you're driving your kid around to therapies and you come home and you're tired, you know, you eat dinner and the kid oftentimes just goes in front of a screen which we can talk about a little bit more later. I'd like to do that. But sometime just intentionally, you have to intentionally set aside 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and actually sit down and write it down. Make a list, and make a list of the things in your community that you can take your kid to that don't necessarily cost any money. Therapy is so expensive, but there are therapeutic activities and experiences that we can expose kids to.
Well, just taking them out to the park and like identifying different types of plants and trees. And then you could take pictures of those different plants and then you could come home and look them up online. I'm all for using the internet to do those sorts of things. But too many kids are getting addicted to video games and then they turn into a 22-year-old young adult addicted to video games. And the problem is that for people on the autism spectrum, video games are extremely addictive. And if you end up having an adult that's addicted, you've got to replace it with something else. There's been some successes with replacing it with car mechanics. And you've got to make a slow transition. And the three of the people just found out that fixing cars was more interesting than video games.
Yeah. One of the things that we talk about in this book and also in our previous book, The Loving Push, is that the autistic brain is often wired in a way that video games just suck you in and you don't have any idea of how much time you're spending in front of the screen and you don't have any idea of the effect on your emotions. So when we ask kids after they play a video game, do you feel better? Oftentimes they'll say they feel better and then it relaxes them. But if you measure their physiological responses, it's not true. They have a skewed perspective and actually, you know, their cortisol levels are up, their stress levels are up. It's really not a good thing. I know you've talked about, you will not allow yourself to go close to video games because you had an experiment once with them.
Well, I played a video game. So I thought I'd played it for 30 minutes and I'd played it for 4 hours. I don't have any of that stuff on my computer. Now I have to keep up with what the subject matter is in video games. When I talk to parents, I look at trailers. I can't play those. I'll just look up the YouTube videos that show what's on the game. But I won't have any of that stuff on my computer or on my phone.
Yeah, yeah. I really hope that parents listening will believe us when we say that it truly is, can be physiologically, certainly emotionally addicting. Well, and
now you look at someone like Elon Musk. He got into video games, into programming them, and into selling them. He wanted to start a video game store, and he was too young to sign the lease. I checked out the games that he would have played. He would be just old enough to have avoided the most addictive games. It would have been Donkey Kong and Mario the Plumber, and those just weren't addictive the same way. Also, they broke all the time. So you got blue screens of death full of code, which, of course, someone like Elon Musk get interested in that code. Then it gets the kid interested in programming. I call that computers showing their guts. And they don't do that anymore.
Well, the developers have gotten pretty slick these days. They have a whole army of folks who are just there to increase the addictive factor.
Well, that's the whole thing. With all this been discussion about a lot of different platforms, these algorithms are designed to keep you on the platform, whether it's social media or whether it's a video game.
Right. And what's interesting is that the developers in Silicon Valley, they do not let their own kids play.
That's right. That's right. They keep their kids off video games because they know how addictive they are. And I want to get kids out, you know, working with real things. The other question that comes up all the time, and of course, in mindset number 7 in Navigating Autism, it talks about developing strengths. And I want to discuss what's the difference between a strength and ability and an interest or maybe a fixation. A strength would be something like visual thinking, drawing, mechanical ability, musical ability, mathematical ability, good learning foreign language ability, writing. Those are strengths. Now, an interest would be cars, horses, salamanders. Those would be interests. And some of these interests get pretty fixated. When I was a little kid, I'd just draw the same horse head over again, over and over again, same horse head. You've got to broaden it. Let's draw the barn. Let's draw a place you might ride the horse to. You see how I'm making an associative link back to the interest. You want to broaden it. You read about horses. You can read about the history of the auto industry. You could do physics and math with cars.
Yeah, sometimes I think we just focus in and say, oh, it's a fixation and we need to eliminate it. That fixation could be someone's career. That fixation exactly. could change the world.
Exactly.
Yeah. I always say the people who've really changed the world, especially in the scientific realm, the majority have probably been on the spectrum throughout.
Well, mankind. I think that's probably true. Thomas Edison, I'm pretty sure, is on the spectrum. Michelangelo dropped out of school at age 12, and he would be probably on the spectrum today. Now, he was exposed to great art because all right. the churches were commissioning art. Also, he grew up using stone cutting tools. He was exposed to the tools of the trade, too.
Let's talk a little bit, let's shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about the things that can get in the way of kids, even if they are exposed. Things like sensory sensitivity.
Sensory can really be a problem. When I was a child, a school bell went off and hurt my ears like a dentist drill. I didn't like balloons popping. Now, sometimes you can reduce these problems if the child controls it. What should have been done with my balloons popping would be to take a balloon and I'm only making it this big. So when I stick it with a pin, it's not that loud. Then gradually I make them bigger and I stick them with a pin and I'm controlling it. Then you might get to tolerate it. There was another kid who could not stand the sound of a big buzzer on the scoreboard in the gym. So they let the kid go down there when the gym was empty and play with the button. And then he started tapping out tunes on it. Now, one of the biggest problems we can get in a classroom is flickering of lights. Some of the cheap LED lights flicker. I just recently read an article in which they dissected those cheap light bulbs that are LED. And I can actually see flicker. It doesn't bother me because it's very slight, but there's other people on the spectrum, also other people labeled dyslexic and people with head injuries that will also see this flickering and it just drives them crazy. Old fashioned incandescent lights don't flicker, but you can't hardly buy them anymore. But there's a zillion kinds of LED lights and you've got to find ones that don't flicker. That would probably be the number one environmental thing in a classroom that would probably be a big, huge problem for 20 or 30% of people with autism.
Mm-hmm.
And not then, everybody, but I'm going to guess it'd be 20 or 30%.
Right, but you always want to check. You know, I think one of the things we say in the book, I don't know if we actually use the term or not, but is that you want to be a detective.
Yeah.
And so we have lots of checklists in the book that help parents or educators or therapists go down and we try to think of all the questions we can ask to see what's going on. And so it may not be that the majority of kids have that problem with the lights, but if yours does, that's all that's important and you've got to check it out. So,
well, the other thing on mindset number four is medical conditions in conjunction with autism. And the research is very clear, gastrointestinal problems, skin problems, those are two things that tend to be worse. And you might have a behavior problem, especially in somebody who's nonverbal, because their stomach hurts and they can't tell you. And doctors tend to get label locked and say, well, it's just autism. Well, maybe he needs to be treated for acid reflux, maybe with over-the-counter medicine, something simple.
Yeah, yeah. And certainly the chapter after that is about psychiatric and emotional conditions associated with autism, and anxiety is at the top of that list.
Anxiety is a big one. When I got into puberty, my nervous system was on fear overdrive. And on just a recent Zoom call I was on, I got asked, well, is that because society was rejecting you? And I said, no, it was innate. My nervous system was revved up to fight off lions and wolves. Like I was in a jungle full of dangerous predators, but they weren't there. I found out on a brain scan, my fear center was triple big. And it was absolutely awful. And in my early 30s, I went on a low dose of an antidepressant. And that's discussed in my book, Thinking in Pictures. It's discussed in detail in there. In fact, I got it right here in detail in Thinking in Pictures. And the medicine worked. Now, there's way too many drugs thrown around like candy. And a big mistake made with antidepressants when you use them for anxiety is too high a dose. That's the number one mistake that's made. And if you have a severe anxiety problem, I'd recommend reading Thinking in Pictures because I don't want any misunderstanding about medication. But There's some adults on the spectrum that talk about autistic burnout. I think it's the anxiety. I get to dip that project shown in the movie without the medication, but I don't know if I could have become a professor because my health was falling completely apart.
Well, that's the thing. Once you have anxiety, you're going to have a cascade effect, and it's going to affect, you know, your entire body.
Well, that's the problem. And when I went on the medication, I go, wow, I'm a believer in biochemistry. And that's what I named the chapter in Thinking in Pictures, a believer in biochemistry. Because like 3 days later, low dose, just a starter dose, it was like magic. And the thing you don't want to do is get into an escalating dose. My nerves kind of went in cycles. And I kind of got anxious again. And I just toughed out the cycle. I've been on the same dose for 40 years. That's why I still have to drink water. But I've also seen really awful stuff done with medication. It was a hideous case just about 10 days ago. I was at a conference and a young man came up and he was hugely fat. That was from Risperidol and diabetic. And then they put him on another one of the antipsychotics and it wrecked his ability to do math. I mean, this is like a real mess. He should have been instantly taken off of that. And then he found another drug that worked, but it was more expensive and Medicaid didn't want to pay for it. And the whole thing was just a gigantic mess. And that's like how not to use medication. But I am taking one little small medication and safety. And I know some other people that are visual thinkers like me that I worked with professionally on a low dose of Prozac, worked really, really well.
Yeah. Well, sometimes what we think is depression is actually just a secondary effect of chronic anxiety. You know, if you've got anxiety long enough, you get depressed.
Well, the problem is that I couldn't sleep. I'd wake up in the middle of the night with my heart pounding. The other thing I found that really helped was a burst of hard exercise every single day. 100 sit-ups every day. I despise every single one of them. But,
but you still do them every day.
I hate exercising. But I like the effects of them. I can't sleep if I don't do those exercises, even with the medication. And the other thing, don't expect a medication to give you 100% control because it won't. Be satisfied with 80%.
Yeah. What advice would you give, Temple, to parents whose child has been recently diagnosed?
Well, let's not overgeneralize here. Okay, if the child is a little kid, 2 or 3 or 4, I can tell you pretty standard stuff. Early intervention, you got to start now. Don't wait 2 years for diagnosis, little kids. Now, I think where navigating autism is really good is for the parent with a newly diagnosed kid and they're freaking out over it. And but let's say it's an older elementary school kid, 8 years old, gets diagnosed and he's fully verbal, no friends. Well, I get worried there about sometimes a label holding that kid back. The more severe kids that remain nonverbal get diagnosed younger. Now, for older adults, I mean, granddads that are in good jobs, fully verbal, maybe had very little speech delay. I had severe speech delay. They get diagnosed and it's like a relief. Now they understand why their relationships are a complete mess.
And there are a lot of fathers and grandfathers out there of kids who realize that once their kid gets diagnosed that, oh, these sounds awful lot like me, or you'll see
that. Or some brother or uncle or something like that. You start seeing the traits. It's a true continuous trait.
How would you explain, let's say, a 10-year-old who's been diagnosed and they say to you, what is autism? What would you say?
Well, let's say it's a 10-year-old. I want to qualify it, a fully verbal 10-year-old.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Fully verbal 10-year-old. I'm gonna tell that kid, well, Einstein probably had autism. Elon Musk had autism. And you can kind of look at it this way. Social skill, the social emotional connection, that eats up a lot of processor space in the brain. So how am I going to allocate the processor space? I'm going to allocate it more towards social emotional, or I'm going to allocate it more towards mathematics or art or engineering or something like that. So a brain can either be more cognitive and thinking or brain more social emotional. Now, if I take half of all the population, they'll probably be on the social emotional side going from, and they take the other half more on the geek or the autism side. And when this very slightly geeky turn into autism, there's no black and white dividing line. So half of the population, I guess, would probably have a little, you know, would have some degree of autism. You've got the, computer geek guy that's usually not very athletic, and he's more interested, or she's more interested in what they do. Because I notice a lot of people, they'll chit chat back and forth, like in a restaurant, they go and they're having such a great time talking about nothing, and they're having such a great time. And part of my problem is I can't get into the rhythm of that, and I can't hear half of it because it's going by too fast. Now, what I tend to do at parties is find somebody one-on-one to talk for a while, and then I'll find somebody else to talk one-on-one for a while.
And that's good advice for any person of any age. And the other thing you've talked about, which is really good advice, is to find someone who shares your interests.
Yes. Well, I was bullied in high school. And the only place I was not bullied was friends through shared interests. I cannot emphasize that enough. In high school, it was horses and electronics lab and model rockets. And when I was college, even I got bullied. And we had a big variety show. And I sung a silly song in the variety show. And I made scenery for the variety show. And a lot of the bullying at college stopped after that. Again, friends through shared interests. They also could see what I did, because once I learned in my business, I learned to sell my work, not myself. For example, this is a drawing of one of my jobs right here, and there's a picture of one of my jobs. So I would simply show people samples of my work. I learned to sell my work rather than my personality.
Right. Right. And everyone who's going for any kind of a job who has work to show should do that.
Well, the thing is that what's happening in a lot of business, HR, human resources, are going more, you know, they're giving personality tests and things like that. And what I think we need to do for a lot of jobs is short circuit the regular interview process. You got to get the portfolio in the hands of the people that would appreciate that portfolio, like computer programming staff or the equipment people or art people, whatever the skill is.
Right. You were talking about geeking out a minute ago. I'm curious, what are the fun things you like to geek out on these days?
Well, I remember when the first SpaceX rocket was docking with the space station, and they had a 2.5-hour live feed. I watched the whole thing. You know, that was a geek out.
That was a good day.
Yeah. Now, when it took off, when it launched, I was a nail biter until it was safely in orbit.
Yeah. I could keep asking you questions and we could keep chatting forever. I think maybe we'll turn now and see what kind of questions people may have and go from there.
Happy to jump in here. Thank you both for that conversation. Let's see what we have in the Q&A. I'll have to say that I geeked out when I was watching SpaceX 2 try to dock, and also when they landed the rocket again for the first time.
Oh, it's amazing how they land that rocket on its tail.
Incredible.
Like a 1950s rocket. And well, they had to have computer power to do that. You see, back when they landed on the moon, there's no way they could have done that because they had a suitcase-sized computer that was probably 1/100th of a phone's ability. And there was a guy named Hal Laning, an algebra specialist, who did equations that made that computer more efficient and was probably essential for the successful landing on the moon. An algebra specialist, his name was Hal Laning. He did algebra for play. And he admitted other people did all the work, but his equations were mission critical.
Well, here's a question that unfortunately has nothing to do with space. How do you think the pandemic and school closures over the last academic years have impacted those on the spectrum? So much of their learning and therapies are hands-on. Thank you.
Well, for little kids, I think it was really bad. And that was also true for regular little kids. The younger the kids, the worse the pandemic stuff was. He says, no way you can do speech therapy or something like that, you know, over Zoom. About all you can do is coach somebody else in the home that would be doing it. No, it's been a real mess. I mean, I talked to a teacher right in the height of the pandemic, a second grade teacher, regular ed students. She said half her students weren't logging on. It was a mess. And the other problem is internet access. That's the other big problem. And one of the things we just learned with Deborah tonight, her internet's been spotty. Well, I'll tell you what you do. You get that laptop much closer to the router. And that helped. And you're in the kitchen right now, but it doesn't look like the kitchen because we got the pot off the stove or whatever it was. But that can make a difference. But there's some places where they don't have the internet. I mean, during the pandemic, we have students on ranches. I had one student that he was in his car. He had to drive to a hotspot behind a McDonald's or whatever, get a signal.
Another question. Can you say more about the different developmental needs and stages? I hear what you're saying about how we're succeeding with younger children, but missing things with older kids and young adults.
Well, the biggest problem is not learning working skills, not learning life skills. I'm just appalled that, you know, we got high school kids who've never gone shopping. That was something I've learned as a, you know, in elementary school. I had an allowance and I was taught to save, and 50 cents could buy 5 Superman comics in the 50s. And if I wanted that 69-cent airplane, I had to save for 2 weeks. I learned that as a very young child. And there's a tendency for some parents to overprotect. Now, some basic principles, no surprises. You do a gradual, you know, moving into the shopping. Like maybe, we stop at a gas station and you just have them run in the store and buy something. And you're right there where you can see it while you're putting gas in the car. You see, as a visual thinker, I see that. I can even pick out the best gas station where I could see into the store. So you're doing it. It's a gradual transition. And I'd like to have 2 real jobs successfully held before they graduate from high school. There's a tendency to wait too long, but gradual transitions that steadily move ahead. But we've got to do it. I'm just appalled that smart students doing well in school, basic life skills, ordering food in restaurants, taking the bus, haven't been taught this stuff.
I think, you know, part of the difficulty is that kids don't necessarily want to learn those things. And parents are tired, and they slip by because you're concentrating so much on the academics. And even in IEPs, they're concentrating very much on things that for some kids are not going to be necessary. And the IEPs need to start much earlier with transition. They can't wait till 11th grade or senior.
No. The things like a volunteer job at age 11, something that will replace that old paper route, because they need to learn how to work on a schedule outside the family. Really important. I'm also seeing some parents have trouble letting go. When I suggest something like their kid going in and just buying some printer paper or some other thing in a store.
Yeah, I often worked with the parents as much as kids in terms of anxiety levels, and checking a parent's anxiety so that they could tell whether that was really what was getting in the way, not the kids. They were often more anxious than the kids. And if they would just step back a minute and recognize that, they could push through their own anxiety and let the kid make mistakes. That's another really important piece of this, is that autistic kids tend to be perfectionist. And when you put that in with the anxiety, it's a bad combination. We can't give in to that. We need to let them. They're going to be really upset. Most of these kids really, really upset, even at small mistakes. And the only way that they learn to cope with that is to have it happen over and over.
I think another problem is if you take hands-on things out, I think that's going to make kids worse on being afraid of making mistakes. You see, that's the problem. You do hands-on things, you're going to make mistakes, and then you just have to try doing it again. But I've taken kids, I was in Chile at an autism meeting, and I knew this one girl who had never bought anything in a store. And I knew she liked National Geographic. So we were just walking around in the stores. And I went in this old magazine store and they had a National Geographic in it. And I pointed to it and I said, buy it. And then I walked away. So I was watching her. She bought it. And she was so happy. That was the first thing that she bought in a store all by herself.
It's amazing what kids can do if we assume that they can do it instead of making an assumption that underestimates them. I think we underestimate autistic kids.
But I did it kind of in baby steps. We were at the store, in the store, and I saw the National Geographic and I pointed to it and I pointed it. I don't know any Spanish, so I said, National Geographic. She knew that word. And I pointed to her purse, said, buy it. And then I just walked outside. Okay, so she bought it. But you see how that's kind of a baby step? I didn't send her 5 blocks right down the road to go find it. You start out like that. And she successfully bought it. She was real happy with herself.
The sense of mastery goes a long way.
Yeah.
Questions are starting to filter in at a more rapid rate here. Someone asks, do you know medical marijuana has helped reduce anxiety in people with autism?
I am very concerned about high potency marijuana. I've looked things up on the PubMed database. It's scary. This stuff is like 5 times stronger than the stuff that we would have had in my generation. And you see, the THC in low doses can relax you. But real high doses, you can get paranoia and anxiety and really get some problems. And I want them to stay away from this high potency stuff. Boy, I can tell you, I won't touch it. I'm concerned. I was shocked when I looked it up and found out that the THC levels were like 5 times higher. And I found scary papers on the PubMed database. I just typed in, marijuana potency levels. Those scary papers. I think there needs to be some limits on the THC.
Deborah, you had mentioned talking about revising IEPs, and someone asks, our 5-year-old grandson was diagnosed 7 months ago with autism too. He has always been verbal. Do you feel that a traditional school environment along with an IEP will be equipped to accommodate his?
This kid is 7 months old?
No. He's 5 years old, but he was
5 years old. Okay.
Months. Yeah.
Well, at this point, you don't really know.
That's a general question. There is such variability from school district, from state to state, from school district, even from classroom, from teacher to teacher. I think you have to know your local resources and you have to be willing to try. And if it's not a good fit, to advocate and move. I think absolutely try, but it really depends on the expertise in your area, and it varies. There's no federal regulation really of that trickles down.
Well, the other thing is everything gets back to who teachers are. Yeah. I mean, with little kids, always say, I want 20 hours a week of one-to-ones with an effective teacher. And I have found good teachers know how to engage these kids. I saw one the other day, he'd taken a green plastic base from a Lego set and was kind of flapping it around, and well, the kid thought that was just great, was getting totally engaged. And some teachers have this knack and they know just how hard to push. You got to push hard enough to get progress, but don't drive them into sensory overload. They know just how to do it. And I have observed that regardless of the name of the program, everyone's fighting about ABA or floor time or this and that. Good teachers do the same thing. So I want progress. What's progress with a 4-year-old or 3-year-old? More speech, more ability to take turns. We got to teach these kids how to wait and take turns. I had a huge amount of emphasis on that in my program. And then basic skills, dressing, brushing their teeth, eating with utensils, basic skills. Those are the kind of things I want in 3-year-olds.
More questions about specific children's behavior. Somebody asked, they have a 2.5-year-old who, let me start again. If a 2.5-year-old has great receptive understanding, but is nonverbal, what is the proper way to proceed? And then continuing, she has been diagnosed at the beginning of the spectrum. She has nonstop action and loves to jump and move. what can be done in COVID times to help this?
Well, a 2.5-year-old, I was nonverbal until age 4. And at 2.5 years old, that's the same age that I went into therapy. And there was a lot of one-to-one speech therapy and lots of turn-taking games. And we need to find somebody. The mom can't do this all herself. Going to have to get somebody in to help.
But it doesn't have to be a professional.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. It has to be somebody that can engage this kid. I mean, I've done a lot of talks in real low-income areas. The only support group they've got is their church. I said, you've got to get some grandmothers to come in to work with this kid. And what you're going to find is some of them will have the ability to kind of draw this kid out and others don't. I call it the knack. And I know that's not being very scientific, but I've observed a lot of things in my life that the worst thing you can do is nothing. Somebody needs to be putting a lot of hours into that kid now on things like teaching speech, turn taking, and some basic skills. And just take them out and take them out in the park and have them collect leaves and make a game out of it.
If this is a kid who has a need for a lot of physical movement and stimulation, then you've got to give that to them. You can't expect them to sit still and learn. They need to be, if they need to be upside down to learn better, let them be upside down.
Right.
If they need to be walking around, let them walk around. Even when I would do evaluations, for instance, for kids like that, there's no way you're going to get an accurate sense or the best sense of a kid if you expect them to be still. So we break up, you know, every 5 or 10 minutes and just push a ball back and forth, something maybe heavy to lift for a second. Get some energy out of them so that the brain can re-engage.
Yeah, that's what mother used to say, go outside and run the energy out of you.
Yeah.
So she used to tell me. But 2.5, that's right when I went into therapy. And there was lots of turn-taking games done with me outside. You can be, with my sister and I, toss a ball back and forth. It's a little older with board games, but this learning how to wait and take turns is super important.
Here's an interesting question. My son is on the spectrum, and I now realize that my father, aged 70, is clearly on the spectrum. How could I start this conversation with him? Any thoughts? I think it would help him.
Well, I have another book called Different, Not Less, and it's 18 older people telling their own stories. I was the editor of this book, telling their own stories about getting diagnosed later on in life. These are people all employed, a wide range of different jobs. And it gave insight into relationships. And I think if he read that, where it's 18 people in their own words telling about their experiences getting diagnosed later in life, that would probably be helpful.
What's the name of the book again?
It's called Different, Not Less. Got it right here. It's Different, Not Less. And that would probably be very helpful to him. And then another, now for just a lot of little tips on how to work with kids. This is the way I see it. There's a lot of information here on sensory problems, and it's sort of a whole lot of little chapters of how to. Well, I think Navigating Autism is like a really good book for the, they're diagnosed, now what do I do? And then Different, the way I see it, then has little specific how-to instructions for things like, what's the world like for a nonverbal child? I've got a chapter in there about Tito. And he talks about problems with controlling movement and with the visual images breaking up and like mosaic patterns. And
this is a question from a speech and language pathologist who works for a company, and therapy is only provided online. Many of my students are on the spectrum. I am responsible for direct service. Do you have any suggestions for developing social and communication skills?
And everything's online. Now, that's going to be difficult. And the younger the kid is, the more difficult it is. And this is where the therapist probably has to watch somebody else in the home do the therapy and coach them. Another thing I run into all the time is a school might provide an hour of speech and an hour of OT a week. That's not enough for a real little kid. So what you need to do is get other volunteers in the community to work with this kid and be coached by the professional teacher, because online that therapist can coach somebody else how to do the therapy. That will work. You know, you put, get the camera so they can see what's going on. They can coach you on how to work with the kid. But trying to just work with a three-year-old online is like useless.
Somebody asked, those of us on the spectrum who need support services to function, including to communicate, do you have any ideas about adult services?
Well, that's going to vary a lot depending on where you're at. This is, you know, it's a real general question. Okay, what kind of supports do you need? See, this is the thing that's so variable. This is where verbal thinkers overgeneralize. They overgeneralize. Okay, and Deborah's there smiling now because she's a very verbal person. It's been good working with her because she's understanding more visual thinking, which is specific. You see, my kind of mind, I take specific examples to make concepts. All right, let's take something like jobs that where people have been successful, jobs that have been disasters. Okay, busy McDonald's takeout window, absolutely not. Chaotic clothing store during the holidays, another disaster. Successes, selling cars, ice cream shop, that was successful. Office supply store was successful. Okay, what are some of the common factors these jobs have in common? There's no multitasking. You do one ice cream cone at a time.
Is there also sort of a national clearinghouse where this person could get information that would steer him to a local organization?
I would recommend looking up your local autism support groups and talking to local people in your area that would know where the services are, because that's going to vary totally. But getting involved with local support groups, and there'll be other people there that can help you to find what's available where you live.
Yeah. The national folks aren't going to know your community. You want to talk to people who are just, you know, one step ahead of you on the journey.
What I have found, I was on a call recently, the Minneapolis area, and some questions came up. And then all of a sudden in the chat, they're saying, oh, well, this place has this. And they were writing it in the chat. And that's the kind of interaction that's just really, really helpful.
Facebook
that's talking about some specific service and they go, well, you can get it here. Let's say assistive communication devices, for example, would be a service.
Handful of questions here. Can you share any strategies to overcome a child's fear of making mistakes? You were talking about the parents before. How about the child's fear of me?
Well, let's just start with some hands-on projects. I can't find my paper snowflake right now, but in my book, Calling All Minds, it's got all my little childhood aviation experiments in here. And I had to tinker to make this stuff work. I've got simple projects like a paper snowflake, but also a little bird kite that I had to tinker with for hours to get it to work. You know, kids can learn to tinker. And I think this is one of the things that makes them scared of making mistakes, is because they're not doing things with real things. That's why it's gotten to be such a problem, because I think this problem's gotten worse. You know, I learned to learn from mistakes. So you cut out a paper snowflake wrong, you get another piece of paper, and then maybe you look it up on YouTube if it fell apart.
I think parents can also role model making mistakes, even if you have to do it on purpose. I used to, when I have a kid and I knew that was an issue, I would have a paper cup, put a little bit of water, just a little bit in, sit it by my chair, my therapy chair, and pretend to accidentally knock it over. I knocked it over on purpose. And then I could talk out loud about, what did I learn from that? Oh, I guess I put that cup too close to my hand, huh? I'm going to have to move it. Let's see, where could I move it next time? And often the kid would pick it up for me. So that was a good experience. But they would also hear me not putting myself down and finding a solution for the next time. So parents can do that. Parents, I mean, you know, we all make mistakes all the time. So you're not going to be lacking examples. Just start talking about your own mistakes and bring some humor to it. Keep it light and let your kid hear that day in and day out.
What suggestions do you have for parents of teenagers on the spectrum who are very set in their likes and dislikes? My 17-year-old son has autism spectrum disorder and is very bright, but despite being told by doctors that he has no sensory issues, he still will only eat specific foods. I've tried getting him to help with dinner, but he still just wants his McDonald's nuggets and French fries.
Well, sometimes, you know, working with food prep helps. If that's all he ate and he didn't take vitamins, I'd be very concerned about vitamin deficiencies. If he's really smart, maybe we can learn more about, you know, good nutrition. Maybe that might help him to broaden out a little bit. Now, younger kids that are picky eaters, just getting them involved in food prep, and then they can play with different foods out in the kitchen. We don't want play at the dining room table with food, but getting them to handle, you know, some carrots or something, you know, might be something new for them to eat. That sometimes is helpful. The other thing that is a problem is real rigid thinking, black and white thinking. And you take a concept like good and bad. Well, you can have degrees of goodness, degrees of badness, but I have to learn that by specific example. For example, if I stick gum on somebody's chair, that's bad, but it's not robbing a bank. And killing somebody's worse than robbing a bank. You see, you're making specific examples of degrees of badness or degrees of goodness. Hold the door open for somebody. Yeah, that's good, but it's not Mother Teresa. You see, it's sort of like I can make gradations by sorting specific examples into like slots on a spreadsheet. And it might be good to have 3 or 4 examples in each slot. You might have mischief. You know, then even in criminal law, they've got misdemeanor, then they got felony, and then they've got, you know, they have degrees of badness.
One of the things I would say,
taught with specific examples.
One of the things I would say to the parent is don't try to persuade by emotion. Try to just present logic. A lot of autistic kids have a lot of respect for that. They don't have respect for, it just doesn't ring, it doesn't touch them if you're trying to talk about, you know, do it for mom or do it for somebody or, you know, but if you talk about, look, if you put them in a position where their choice that they're making right now, their rigid choice is illogical, that creates a problem for them because they do not want to be illogical. That's so they have to figure out a way of that. So you may give them, like Temple was talking about, you may give them the idea of the concept of grayscale and then introduce them one notch up. Let them make a list and put it on the grayscale foods. What are the ones they would never, ever eat? Snails, maybe. What are the ones that maybe they would eat? The fries at McDonald's. And get them introduced to that concept using logic. And then oftentimes if it's something that's dangerous, you know, to the kid, if we're really talking about a nutritional deficiency here, you don't give the kid a choice. You tie it to some consequences, some natural consequences, and you push the kid a little bit. And if it results,
I might show them as an old 50s textbook of the old nutritional deficiency diseases like scurvy. And actually a kid got that. The autistic got that because he wasn't eating vitamin C.
I had a client who this was an issue for, and actually he's profiled using his real name, pictures and everything in the Loving Push. And we just gradually introduced some foods, and his aunt would take him out to restaurants and he would just be totally overwhelmed, but she kept doing it and doing it, doing it. You can't expect to do it 2 or 3 times and solve the problem. We're talking months and months of repetition. And eventually I remember the day he said to me, "Oh my God, I discovered fish. I think it's my gateway food." and now he, you know, he's in his 20s and he cooks. And, you know, he's not a chef, but he can take care of himself in terms of giving himself nutritious food. But you would never have predicted that was where he was going to end up.
We've got one more question before we wrap it up this evening. And it sort of brings us full circle to the idea of thinking in pictures. How do you communicate in pictures with a nonverbal child?
Well, first of all, how old is the child?
Ah, there's the rub. Unless the person responds immediately.
Okay, now the thing is, it depends what you want to see. A lot of nonverbals can, you know, you might have a picture board with favorite toys, foods on it. Now, one of the mistakes I see on some of these picture boards is they make the pictures too schematic. No, let's just have, you know, like real realistic pictures of, you know, a cup of milk, let's say, or because some of the nonverbals may be thinking in pictures. And, you know, they're thinking in sensory. And so they'd understand like maybe a picture board. And then you have electronic devices where there's an icon there, a picture of the glass of milk, and then you punch the button and it says milk electronically. And then they start to understand that words have meaning. They probably are thinking in pictures, so thinking in sensory. Now, some individuals that are nonverbal smell and touch things. And the reason for doing that is those senses still work and provide accurate information. We're seeing maybe like a really bad satellite TV where the image is pixelating.
Would you mind taking one more question?
No, we'll do it.
One seems pretty important to me. This person writes, my six-year-old son still will not have a bowel movement, and I have literally tried everything. ABA has provided strategies. We have tried a potty stool. He will sit on the toilet, no problem, but refuses to go. What are some suggestions you would recommend for him to overcome this fear? My son is verbal and in a mainstream first grade classroom.
And has he been checked out by a doctor to make sure he doesn't have something wrong with him? Yeah, see, the problem is I don't have quite enough information. Does he do it in a diaper?
Obviously, he has bowel. I would think he has bowel movements.
Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking.
That's what I was thinking.
And he will sit on the toilet. Yeah.
When I was a kid, I was a little bit afraid of getting sucked down things. And if I had been exposed to some of the industrial strength automatic restrooms that, you know, you have at the airport and places like that, I would have been terrified. I could have been sucked down it. Oh, an airplane toilet? Oh, as a kid, I would have been terrified. Oh, sure, I'm going to be sucked out of the airplane.
Yep.
And one of the things that can sometimes help with these things, if you understand how it works. And one mom, her kid was terrified of the hand dryers in the bathroom. So they went on all the websites for the companies that sold these things. And they got the kid interested in how they worked. And when you get interested in something, then it's a lot less scary. You see, there may be something about it he's scared of. But this is also an example of a don't quite have enough information to give the best advice.
But that advice in general, I'm glad that question brought that up because that's really important, is that fear and curiosity don't go together. So if you can get someone curious and interested, and oftentimes to do that, you have to really show them how things work and really get them up close and touching, then the fear can diminish.
Well, when I was in high school, I was in a very scary emergency landing in a plane, and we had to go down the chutes. And after that, I was terrified of planes. And the way I got over that, I had a chance to ride in the cockpit of a plane hauling Holstein heifers to Puerto Rico in my 20s. And now aviation became interesting. You see, that's one of the ways you make something interesting that tends to make you less afraid of it. The other problem you've got with some of the nonverbal individuals is they have to see an entire task demonstrated. Okay, on the toileting, we'll leave it at that. I'm going to use a t-shirt example. Okay, one of the things that Tito talked about is if you took a t-shirt and you yank it on him fast and you shove it on him fast, he can't follow how the t-shirt works. So what they did is they very slowly put it over his head and then put his arms through it. Another thing you do is have somebody demonstrate very slowly putting on a t-shirt. Got to see the whole task. And otherwise, if you leave a step out, they don't understand what they're supposed to do. Yeah, they need to get demonstrations of things and the whole task is shown.
And you know, if we get a little bit graphic here, most kids are real interested in certain bodily functions. And you might want to use some animals, find some National Geographic Planet Earth movies, and let the kid watch maybe some animals having some bowel movements. You want to demystify it one way or another. And there aren't too many kids who are going to turn away from that sort of image.
Sounds like helpful advice. And I think I don't want to leave it at that image, but I do want to, if I had your book, I would hold it up. The book is Navigating Autism. The authors are Dr. Temple Grandin and Dr.
I've got it right here to hold
up. Oh, perfect.
Okay, I'll get it so you can see.
Great. Thank you both very much for your time and your thoughts and your answers this evening. It was educational and entertaining as well. And Temple, it was great to see you again after all these years.
Well, really good to see you. And you had, I noticed you had about 90 people on the show, and then you post on YouTube and probably more people watching.
Yeah, we had 100 and some odd cycle through, and it'll go on to our YouTube page in the coming days. That's youtube.com/author events. And it will also be a podcast on the Free Library of Philadelphia website. So people will find it there in the coming days.
Well, I think the thing that makes it hard with autism is just such a big spectrum. I mean, you're going from Einstein to somebody can't dress themselves and it's got the same name. And as a visual thinker, that to me is just ridiculous that you'd even put those two in the same category. See, when the kids are little, I look really severe when I was little. See, when the kids are little, they look the same.
And then things change. Well, thank you very much. And maybe we'll see you at some point in Philadelphia when this whole thing ends.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay.
Thank you. Deborah,
thank you. Good night, Temple.
Good to talk to you. Good night.
Good night.
We'll leave the webinar.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/author events.